Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Robin Hicks. We welcome to the studios of CBS Interactive Fleur Brown, CEO of public relations agency Launch Group.
Morning, Robin.
And podcast producer Alice Terlikovsky.
Hi, Robin.
Mumbrella editor Tim Burrows is on his way to Cannes as we record today. This week,
paywalls, promises, and Gen Z at Mumbrella 360.
Binning the broadsheet, The Age and The Herald in tabloid talk.
The latest ad campaigns to hit the telly.
Kellogg's announces its PR Twitter shortlist. So, Fleur, thanks for joining us. This is the first time on the Mumbrella Cast. First of all, can you tell us a bit about what's been happening at the Launch Group?
Sure. Well, we're just wrapping up the TEDx Sydney event, doing a debrief on that on Monday and looking at planning, would you believe it, for TEDx Sydney 2012. Seems
right.
Incredible, but it really does take a year to turn those kinds of events around. We're very happy with the success of the event this year and feel like the TEDx brand has really landed, which is not bad in its second year, because we sort of went from an almost zero consciousness of that brand out in the general population to a much stronger resonance this year, which is great to see. We've just taken on a couple of, I guess you could call them cause marketing briefs. We've taken on the NOFS Foundation, which work with at-risk youth. So
right.
Start getting into that next month. And also a new client in the green space. So that's a bit of watch this space. We'll be announcing that shortly. But there's a big event coming up in July, which should be fun. Those are sort of some of the key things
yeah.
on our agenda at the moment.
On your work with the NOFS Foundation, obviously targeting youth, as you mentioned, anything that you can let us know about that you'll be doing with them?
Well, certainly they focus on at-risk youth who have drug and alcohol issues. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of projects which are really quite innovative in that space, which we're excited to get involved with. One of them is Gideon Shoes, which is the famous cane-toed shoe mm-hmm. enterprise.
Yep, yep.
And they've just opened a new store in Bondi last night,
okay.
actually.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so you'll probably see that brand a little bit more of a public presence
yep.
this year. They've been very successful as what we call a social enterprise, which is a space I love because it's about charity actually, you know, funding itself rather than getting handouts.
Sure.
And that money goes back to something called the Street University, which is also a NOFS Foundation initiative.
Oh, okay.
Again, a very innovative project. It's helping, at-risk disadvantaged kids, including kids literally on the street, to access, you know, tertiary-style education. So, you know, quite pioneering projects for Australia, and they're certainly two of the standout initiatives that the NOFS Foundation work with.
Quick work on cause marketing. Given an increasingly cynical public, is it getting more difficult to do cause marketing well?
I would argue it's probably getting easier. And the reason I would argue that is because, this sort of leads into the touches on the Generation Z conversation that we were having at Mumbrella 360. The generation that's coming through, certainly Gen Y, Gen Z, and people would argue people of any age, are a lot more open to a cause-related conversation. And so it gives you an access point with, you know, potential customers that you wouldn't have if you're just having a straight-up commercial conversation. So I think linking corporates and consumer brands to causes is something we're going to see increase rather than decrease.
Yeah, okay. I want to move on to an opinion piece you wrote for Mumbrella recently, which is titled A Memo to Grumpy Editors, That PR is Not the Enemy. This followed on from a story in The Australian by Dan Kaufman about the annoying habits of PR people. So what do you think journalists can do better to improve the relationships they have with PRs?
Well, I think certainly opening up to the possibility that PR people actually really respect their profession on the whole. Now, I know that there's behaviour that goes on out there, as there are in any profession, which undermines that. And I certainly agree with a lot of the commentary around that coming from the junior ranks of PR people who haven't been properly supported and properly trained, and they get sort of let loose on very senior journalists and editors who, you know, don't want to spend the time training them on behalf of those PR agencies or those corporates, and that's fair enough. But I think certainly, part of my title for that piece was that PR is not the enemy, and I think that I know from personal experience, journalists are trained to see public relations as the enemy. And, you know, it's become a game that we play between the two professions where, you know, we dodge bullets, you know, from other sides of the fence. And I think that PR is not the enemy. You know, journalists are probably never going to be as respected by anyone as they are by PR people. PR people go into the profession, you know, largely because they love the news game and they want to support that, you know, that professional practice. So they're certainly not going to get as much support as journalists from the corporates or the executives that they, you know, want to write about. The PR people are their advocates. So I think just opening up to that would be a huge improvement.
Mm, true. Mind you, when I first arrived in Australia in March, my first week I was invited to an agency launch party. And there's great fanfare, lots of people there, very well attended. It's only at the end of the party, a throwaway comment by the public relations person who's representing the new agency said that, well, actually, this isn't really a launch. It's just a rebranding of an agency, an old agency. So it's so that sort of level of sneakiness, for want of a better word, that PRs often try and push boundaries, which obviously they're just doing their jobs. But it struck me as better if they were just a bit more straight up about some of the stories they try and pitch into us.
Yeah, I think there's more courage required. And that was another comment that came through in response to that article. It's difficult, but I think that public relations people do have to be courageous with their clients or, you know, in the case of being an in-house PR with their senior executives, to actually say to those people, this is not a story, you right. know. And I think consumer public relations campaigns are probably more prey to or more susceptible to having to peddle stuff that is not a story than the other side of the equation, you know, the corporate side. And so, you know, you asked me what journalists can do better. I certainly think that, you know, on the PR side that we need to have a little bit more spine when it comes to standing ground and, you know, thinking more creatively about actually having a story to offer rather than taking something out there that we know in our heart of hearts just isn't, you know.
I often wonder, does it give a PR a great sense of satisfaction when the press release they sent to a journalist is published verbatim in that journal? I do wonder, is that how the KPIs work for PRs in terms of sending a press release in? If a journalist runs it as is, are you guys happy with that? Knowing that the story perhaps isn't accurate, isn't the whole story.
Look, I obviously can't speak for a community of PR people. Yeah. Personally, I like to see a lot more interaction with the story on the part of a journalist. I think I'm, you know, very sad to see the resourcing being cut back on the main newspapers in particular, because I think, you know, it's the death of the good feature and the good investigative journalist piece. So in terms of KPIs, it really depends on the client. And I think Australia does not have a hugely educated client base when it comes to using PR services. And so, you know, our company tries to work quite long-term with clients and quite strategically so that over time the clients really come to understand what a good outcome is. So I think, you know, a good outcome is that the messages that are in a story are consistent with what they were trying to get out there. Whether it's verbatim from a press release or not is not really the point. And, you know, once again, if we see that story run across multiple news banners, then there's a generic flavour to it that's actually very unsatisfying. I think, you know, the idea of having a lot of stories running that have very different angles to them is a lot more satisfying professionally.
Yeah.
Fleur, do you think ex-journalists make better PRs?
I think that a love of the news is really, really important for a PR person. It can be acquired, but if you have it in the first place and you're trained in that profession, I think that you're certainly ahead. But on the flip side of that, I think it's really important that PR people also have business experience. And a lot of journalists don't necessarily have experience working within a corporation. So if you can balance the two, you're in the perfect position.
You mentioned the word balance. There's a piece in The Economist recently, you may have seen it, about the talent pools, journalists versus PRs. I think that globally there are double the number of PRs there are journalists, and that balance is tipping. So presumably you guys have a bigger talent pool to choose from. How is that affecting the business, do you think, in Australia? Do you think that balance is true in Australia, that there are far more PRs than journalists, and far more journalists that want to become PRs, perhaps simply because it pays better?
Well, I think increasingly, and I'm sad about this, I think increasingly that possibly is the case. I don't know. I don't have the numbers. But really that relates to what's happening at in the media organisations. They're cutting back resourcing.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really sad day for both sides of the industry. And, you know, hopefully we'll see something that will turn that around, because I don't think it's in anyone's interest to have PR people outweighing, you know, news creators. At the end of the day, the public's not going to want to consume that kind of content. It needs to have that, you know, that journalistic flavour to it and that edge to it that comes from somebody who's really passionate about writing a piece of, you know, journalism. Mm.
So next, paywalls, promises and Gen Z at Mumbrella 360.
At Mumbrella 360, we saw a range of topics raised, as well as some big announcements from some of Australia's key media players. Richard Freudenstein, boss of News Digital Media and The Australian, announced they would introduce a paywall for their web properties by around October. The, in quotes, freemium model means that big content will remain free to browsers, but premium content will cost. There's been no set rules as yet as to what will and won't be free. That will pretty much be up to the section editors. Fleur, would you be likely to subscribe come October?
Well, I think professionally we probably have to. So I'm not sure that my question reflects, you know, my punter's view on that. As a reader rather than a professional, I would subscribe if I felt that it was giving me access to something that, you know, I just couldn't live without, really. So it comes down to the quality of what's offered.
Do you have a particular, at the moment, how do you read your news? Are you a newspaper person on the weekend and online during the week?
I'm very online, yeah. And sort of online all the time. And, you know, as a consumer of online product, I don't like the fact that we see the same stories running across all the news banners, you know, whether it's Fairfax or News Limited, et cetera. You've got the same AAP content on all those sites. I'd like to see more exclusive content developed, you know, something that takes a little bit more of an in-depth view. And if this model allows that to happen, then, you know, I'd certainly be a lot more engaged.
And that's obviously going to be something that they're going to need extra journalists to do.
I think so. And that was a question I had with this announcement is, you know, they're wildly cutting back on journalistic resources, you know, in a lot of the media outlets. So how will they underwrite this model to ensure they get that quality of journalism? Mm-hmm.
Robin, what do you think is going to happen, you know, to their ad revenue as a result?
Well, it depends how high the paywalls are and for what content they apply. Basically, if The Australian can sustain traffic above a certain threshold and keep the enough content strong enough, then I don't see any reasons why advertisers will stray. But if the content that is free is low rent, then presumably the traffic they'll get will be lower income sort of audiences. So I think that will probably affect the ad revenue eventually, yeah.
While we're on 360, Chris Stevenson from PhD also led a session which saw a media manifesto developed by himself and delegates in the room. The areas of the manifesto were broken down into people, post-broadcast planning, agency and media owner relationships, social media, client and agency relationships, data technology and systems, and remuneration. Robin, any standouts for you there?
Yeah, there were three, I think, that stood out. Two that I didn't agree with and one that I did. The first one I agreed with was we believe we should be using social data to inform every communications decision. I'm not sure that's feasible. It seems to me that it's using the wisdom of the crowds to an absurd degree. I mean, if it would perhaps dilute messaging, if anything, rather than strengthen it, and perhaps weaken people's creative instincts. I think instinct's very important, rather than leaning on data whenever you need to make a communications decision. Another one that I perhaps disagree with was we believe that no one enjoys pitches. Who am I to say? I've never been in a pitch, but I've met people for whom pitches are pretty much everything. There's that adrenaline rush it gives them. It's a real trigger of creative energy. So I'm not sure I quite agree with that. The third one that I agreed with was we believe there should be a model that rewards time spent, output and results. Obviously, that's possibly the biggest point I took out of the whole manifesto. I think too many agencies, perhaps Fleur, you agree with this, fritter away far too many high value ideas just for free. And yeah, we did an interview a while back with some young lions, Australian creative agencies, and they said that the biggest frustration they had that was 95% of the stuff that they do, the ideas that they come up with, doesn't see the light of day. It doesn't get realised. And I just think, those are my three takeaway points.
Fleur, just on the pictures thing, it was actually another topic of debate at 360 on whether, you know, do you pitch, do you not, how to win pitches, all of those things. What's your view on the pitch?
I hate pitching. I think clients love it though, because they feel like, they're getting value and they get ideas. But we tend to, probably 80% of our business would not come through the pitch channel.
Okay.
I'm not very hot on kind of getting out there and beating the drum in that area. And maybe it's something I need to pull my socks up on.
So how do you motivate a pitch team, given that knowing perhaps that they don't really enjoy it or that's not part of the job that they relish?
Well, to be honest, we wouldn't pitch for something we weren't somewhat passionate about. So, you know, right there, we've eliminated the possibility of having unenthusiastic people on the pitch team. If we agree to a pitch, it's because we feel that we can commit to that business for, you know, a good couple of years and be passionate about it. Because, you know, back to the previous conversation, if there isn't much news value happening with that client brief, you don't want to be the one that's peddling those stories. So, you know, we check out the client to make sure that they're going to be interesting to work with. And then you do get the enthusiasm, I think.
Yes. So you don't enjoy the theatre of a pitch?
I don't. And, you know, I'm a weird person in that I don't even try and find out who else is who we're up against.
Right.
I find that it sort of undoes me psychologically.
You're superstitious sort of in that way.
Oh, yeah. And I think it just distracts you. You know, I think I like to go in there with a clean offering that's, you know, very much comes from the heart of what we do and not get distracted by, you know, what other companies might be offering.
So if you don't like to go in traditional pitch, how do you go about winning most of your business then?
A lot of it comes through word of mouth, and, you know, it'll come out of a conversation we might be having with, a company about a particular problem that they have. We come in and we might draw up a strategy for them, and that quite often evolves into a long-term ongoing relationship.
You also moderated a session on Gen Z. Now, can you tell us who they are exactly?
Sure. Well, they're obviously the generation after Y. And these age definitions are disputable, I guess. But my view of it is that Gen Y is now sort of 19 or 20 years through to 31. They sort of officially turned 30 last year, which makes Gen Y under sort of 19 years of age. And, you know, we're saying the generation after that, Alpha, as it's now being referred to, and I have to stake a claim that I called them Alpha and I got laughed at in derision about 3 years ago, and now everyone's calling them Alpha.
Well, there you go. You heard it here first.
Yeah. So that's the territory. Just to clear up a point that came up on the Mumbrella comment trail, the research that we put out there on this generation is really looking at teenagers. We're not trying to read the minds of 6 and 7 year old kids. And people would dispute that you can even kind of indicate a lot of, you know, behavioural possibilities from teenagers. I think you can. We've been studying them now for quite a few years.
I presume one thing I took issue with the research about that struck me as odd was that young kids, teenagers, were really dramatically affected by the GFC, financial crisis. I would have thought they'd have been insulated from that, but obviously your research shows that actually the problems that their parents have financially is affecting their kids.
They seem to have a very close relationship with the parents. And, you know, some people will argue, well, all teenagers do, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think with Gen Y, we saw a very free-spirited, independent style of generation and, you know, wanting to get a backpack on as soon as possible and get around the world, etc. This generation seems to be a bit more stay at home, a bit more grounded. They have sort of a closer affiliation with the values of their parents, you know, more traditional. Now, as a consequence of that, they were quite emotionally impacted by what they saw their parents experience during the GFC. For example, we did a survey a year or two back on Christmas, you know, gift giving, and a lot of the kids were saying, don't worry, you know, like this year we're just happy to sort of be okay financially.
Wow.
Let's not have a bumper Christmas, you know. Now, you don't expect that kind of attitude from a teenager necessarily. So I think that all comes down to the emotional relationship they have with their parents.
I didn't expect the association of this generation being ethical either, particularly. Where do you think that comes from?
I think it's a range of sources. Some people will say, and this is not something we've studied, you know, the influence of Gen X as parents, potentially. I think if you look at something like environmental values, they're really teaching that strongly in schools now. And I think what you're seeing come through is not only the attitude shift around green issues, it's the recognition that they have to inherit the planet that might get, you know, destroyed. But it's also translating into behaviour. So it's not just about people claiming that they have green values. These kids actually do the whole thing. They recycle, you know, they want to support brands and do support brands that have those values, etc. So I think it's a bit of a layered conversation. We saw the start of this with Gen Y. I think it's just a little bit more embedded in the next generation.
Well, next, binning the broadsheet, The Age and The Herald in tabloid talk.
To advertise with one of the top 10 most loved brands in Australia, visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
Our editor, Tim Burrows, sat down with Fairfax Metro CEO Jack Matthews recently to chat about the prospects of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald going to a smaller size, moving away from its traditional broadsheet format. Let's have a listen.
I wouldn't want to put a timeline on it, but I'd be surprised. I think I personally would be surprised if into the future, the Monday to Friday, Age or Herald were broadsheet. But you know, I don't want to suggest there's been a decision. I mean, I have an opinion. Other people have opinions. And, you know, we'll work our way through that. But we'll work our way through it pretty quickly.
So the idea was first mooted in 2007 as UK papers, The Independent and The Times, moved to a tabloid size. And the Guardian switched to a Berliner format, which is pretty much in between a tabloid and broadsheet. So, Fleur, do you buy a paper because of its size?
I think certainly if you're taking public transport or you're sort of trying to be moving around a lot in the day, then portability is an issue. You know, if you look at the weekend paper, for example, it's absolutely massive and it doesn't fold up. So, you know, you tend to pick it up in the coffee shop rather than want to carry it around with you. So I think portability is a huge factor. I'm not into the iPad consumption yet, but a lot of my friends are. And so I would also argue, does it really matter in an age when we're shifting towards that form of consumption anyway? People are changing the way that they look at a newspaper entirely.
Yeah. So Alice, do you think it will have the downsizing of the papers? Do you think that'll have an effect on sales at all?
I'm with Fleur in the point that things are moving to more portable, compact ways of finding out all sorts of information. I think if they reduce the size of their paper and also reduce how many inserts are in a weekend paper, then they might have issues. Because I know that when I like to read the paper on the weekend, I've got, I don't know, the lifestyle section and the other half has the sports section and we've got it all over the breakfast table. And that's how we consume it. It's not really the fact that it's all over the breakfast table. Okay, it's massive. But even if it's smaller, we're still, if we can still divvy it up and share and swap after breakfast and whatever, then that'll be fine.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, the moving to online, they're, you know, they've already got iPad apps. They're obviously trying to keep everything as portable as possible to keep it going. The question will be, I guess, is whether advertisers will be willing to pay the same amount for an ad that's essentially smaller. In area. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, I've heard an argument also that, well, you know, advertisers don't pay less for buying a TV spot that's on a small TV screen. Do you know what I mean? Just because you've got a massive widescreen TV, you shouldn't have to pay more. I don't know, Fleur, what do you think about sort of ad rates? Do you think because an ad's a smaller size that newspaper advertisers should pay less?
Not necessarily. I think it's about impact at the end of the day. I mean, we all know that people consume things in bite-size chunks, you know, sometimes more avidly than they do if it's a larger scale offering. Short ads, for example, can have more impact as well. So, yeah, I'm not sure would be my answer.
Yes. Just quickly, I just wanted to ask you, do you have a favourite newspaper? I mean, globally, a lot of people are fans of, say, the New York Times or...
Yeah, look, I love the New York Times. I used to love the LA Times. I lived there for a while, and they had this beautiful column on the right-hand side every day, which was this feature piece. And it's the kind of journalism that I wish we would see more of, you know, these days. Something that probably took, you know, a week to prepare.
Right.
Beautifully written and, you know, with an investigative slant to it, generally on a lifestyle topic. I really, really missed that. Haven't quite seen that here in Australia.
Favourite Australian paper?
Oh. Can I ask
That's
a PR
a tough
person
question?
Yeah,
right.
Well, I have to put my hand up for the Sydney Morning Herald. Although I have this, you know, just going back to the previous conversation, this sort of this sneaking suspicion that you're almost seeing News Limited, you know, head more towards what Fairfax has done, and Fairfax is heading, you know, more towards what News Limited's done. So there's kind of a weird morphing going on in some ways.
Yeah, so that you find that they're harder to differentiate editorially?
Not yet, but, you know, just some of the moves that they're talking about. I mean, even the downsizing, News Limited setting up some paywalls, that sort of thing.
Yes, yes. Okay. So next, the latest ad campaigns to hit the telly.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all of these stories, visit mumbrella.com.au. We've seen a few ads drop in our inbox this week, including the latest for Australian Mining's This Is Our Story campaign, which sees mining employees talk about the importance of the industry. Let's have a listen.
In Australia, you can make yourself whatever you want to be as long as you're prepared to work for it.
G'day, my name is Len Thong and this is my story.
I don't look like a stereotypical miner out there digging up ore, wearing a high-vis shirt. My role is delivering the right information to senior management to make the right decisions for the best of the business. It's such a dynamic environment to work in, and also it's global in nature. The mining life cycle isn't just about digging the dirt, putting it on a ship and then forgetting about it. You pretty much have to project producing something for 40 years. Most super funds, if not all, have mining stocks. You know, mining effectively helps every single Australian. And without a healthy industry, you know, you're not going to be able to get those kinds of returns. I'm Chinese, but I'm born in Vietnam. I came to Australia as an orphaned refugee. I stayed in a refugee camp in Cambodia for a couple of years. So we had to go across the Thai border, and soldiers, they just opened fire randomly, and my parents were shot. We've only got one family portrait of all five of us, and I've got that blown up, framed in the house, just as a reminder every day that, that's what they sacrificed for me.
I mean, he's a wonderful man and a wonderful husband and father. I think they'd be very proud of. I think they're looking down on him and with a big smile on their face.
My upbringing is what really makes me passionate about everything that I do. Without mining, I wouldn't have what I have. I'd like to think that they'd be very proud of me.
Robin, you wrote the story on this one. It's quite a long spot. Is it intended for TV as well as online?
Yeah, no, it's sort of a feature-length sort of cinema-style ad. I think it's really produced. First of all, I have to thank Camille Alacon for this story. She spotted it on Twitter and passed it to us. Yeah, no, I'm slightly cynical about it. I mean, I know the show is not about politics, but it does smack a little bit of greenwash. I know it triggered an amazing response in our comment stream about people that thought that, it was trying to paint an overly pretty emotive picture of an industry that's some said was turning a country into a gravel pit. But yeah, that said, I mean, you know, I think it's very well crafted. There's obviously a lot of money being spent on it, as there is behind the Minerals Council of Australia. So a pretty good ad, and I think it'll be effective.
Over at the telcos, Vodafone has created an ad with Host, which introduces a new Vodafone all-time prepaid offering. It shows a monster-type creature walking around the screen, which is then supported by Kill Your Credit Demons with new Vodafone all-time prepaid. Rob, I don't know about you, but when I first watched the ad, I didn't quite know what exactly, I mean, I knew the name of the product, but I didn't know what the product was about.
Yeah, I sort of got there. I mean, I think it's an ad that's quite clever in its targeting. It's clearly aimed at kids using this sort of fluffy little monster. And I sort of get it's a little bit literal, but I get the execution that kids are annoyed that they're kind of run out of credit. But yeah, I would suspect they're not nearly as annoyed as when they run out of signal, which I understand. I'm not a Vodafone user. I'm fairly new to the market, but I understand that's a big problem for Vodafone. But yeah, no, on the production side of things, I think the ad was pretty tacky.
Yeah.
If I'm honest. That said, I think it might work among younger audiences. That blue creature is perhaps something that'll work as an ad vehicle.
But younger audiences in terms of monsters, I mean, in terms of who's going to be actually making that purchasing decision, monsters and teenagers really are they, you know, is it too young, I wonder?
Yeah, perhaps, but I think most prepaid customers are younger customers. Mm. That's why I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, just another thing on the ad itself, it's notable that the host, the agency behind it, didn't press release it to us.
Okay.
Which they'd usually be more proactive about showing us ads that they're proud of. I think this is one that they'd rather we didn't discover.
Do you think that's because of the attention Vodafone had previously with you know, the whole poor service thing and them having to
quite possibly. But I just think it's hosts were definitely a top three creative agency in Australia, and I think this is something that's not going to win them any awards with Cannes coming up.
Still with telcos, Telechoice have released a series of 15-second spots of people destroying their phones in what its CEO says will keep Telechoice at top of mind next time they need a new handset. It's filmed in hidden camera style, which is hoped to strike a chord with mobile phone users of all ages. It was shot by Melbourne's Fuzzy TV. One of them actually strikes a resemblance with CCTV footage from a US shopping mall where a woman is texting on a phone and she falls into a fountain. Fleur, amateurish?
Look, I think maybe the execution is a little rough, but I think that's the style of ad that they're going for. You know, they're wanting to make it look like it's almost accidental footage. I thought they were, you know, probably quite appealing to a younger audience because they're short and they're mm-hmm. funny. Mm-hmm. And we know that, you know, from testing that those are two key criteria. And then I found myself relating to a lot of it as well, like leaving your phone on the top of a car. So there's something for everyone in that series. I think we've all done it. And it's so frustrating, you know, when you smash up or destroy your phone.
Yeah. I thought that it's quite a down market way of advertising a new product. I'm not that familiar with the brand itself, but phones are usually desirable products. I would have thought that advertising in this way is like a throwaway utility, or they are a utility that just needs to be replaced. It's a strange way of marketing.
Yeah, and I think from what the CEO, forgive me, his name escapes me, said was that they wanted to be front of mind next time you lose a phone. So I think they were pretty upfront in the way that everyone loses their phone. Think about us next time. And yeah, it is a utility that has to be replaced. It's not say in the way that say iPhone or Apple market their iPhones. It's, you know, it does this and it does this and you won't live without it. It's so sexy. And yet this is just, look, it happens to all of us here. Buy a phone with us when you need one again.
So. Yeah, it just strikes me as a brave way of executing an ad for a quite low cost retailer.
Well, next, Kellogg's announces its PR Twitter shortlist.
With more than 94.5 million active users globally, eBay is the world's largest online marketplace. Visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
So cereal brand Kellogg's has announced its shortlist for its PR account after it asked agencies to tweet, in of course 140 characters or less, why they should win the business. If you're interested, the hashtag is Kellogg's PR. On the shortlist is Keep Left PR, Hill & Knowlton, Deck Communications, Mark Communications, Liquid Ideas, and one other agency we haven't found out the identity of. The pitch process will be conducted over the next 3 weeks. So, Fleur, what do you think about how Kellogg's has gone about the process? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's made it easier or harder for agencies to pitch? 140 characters, you can't say a lot about your agency in that sort of length of time, can you?
Well, I thought it was a good PR move on Kellogg's part. And, you know, they got the kind of the first to do it advantage. You know, you can only really do that kind of thing once and get really good PR out of it, I think.
We did look around. We couldn't find another example of it. Mm. Do you think it's a genuine first?
It's the first of its kind in Australia that I've observed. I'm sure it's been done, you know, offshore, maybe even Kellogg's have done it offshore themselves. Does it make it harder? Look, I felt that a lot of the responses that were coming through had a lot of marketing content to them, and really they were looking for a PR agency that was going to get them media coverage. So, you know, some of those ideas certainly demonstrate a lot of effort and creativity and a passion for the brand on the upside. But then I think on the other side of it, the questions I would be asking are, how does that translate into editorial ideas that are going to actually get your client coverage, because they have a marketing company on board and they have a creative agency. So what's the difference here?
Yes. What did you make of the – did you see the video that Keith Leff PR put together, which is obviously a twist on the 140-character limit,
yeah,
where they got 140 punters, consumers, each to hold up a packet of Kellogg's cereal to the tune of Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. And
yeah,
that was the winning –
look, it was cute and compelling, but again, it's only PR if you think about it in social media terms. I think, you know, again, if you're looking at editorial, you know, value or news value to that viral, mm-hmm, it's probably something that's closer to what a creative agency might do. So it demonstrated to Kellogg's that this is a company that's going to go the extra mile for you. They get your brand, they're fun, they're creative. Tick, tick, tick. Does it demonstrate that they're going to get you media coverage? No.
Yes. Yeah. And in the story, follow-up story we wrote about it, Gareth Lucy, who's the head of PR at Kellogg's, was saying that, yeah, this stunt caught attention. It's very creative. But what we're actually looking in a winner out of the final six is genuinely demonstrable business results. We want an agency that can prove, not just creative, that can prove that they can get more than coverage. The coverage they get actually means something and translates to their brand and their business. Not just coverage for coverage's sake.
Yeah, look, I think that's absolutely right. But I would also, you know, add to that that it is very much the client responsibility to define, you know, what those business objectives are and, you know, what their key connection points are with customers, not the PR agency. And then the PR agency needs to deliver to that. So
yeah,
it is a collaboration required there, I think.
Yeah. So Alice, are you a fan of the Keep Left PR approach?
I was and I am, absolutely. But I do agree with Fleur in terms of how it demonstrates that they can actually reach those KPIs. So, yeah, I looked at it and I was bopping away to Wham! And, you know, I thought it was cool. So, you know, and especially because they were creative in the 140 characters or less, no one said that you couldn't include a link to anything else. So
right.
I assume it wasn't in the terms and conditions of the competition. But Fleur, I wanted to ask you, not being a fan of the traditional pitch process, was it something that you guys considered pitching for?
I did a really lame tweet.
What was it?
I talked about, you know, being able to balance, you know, the building of a brand and also reputation management. I think we probably lean as an agency a little bit more away from the consumer side, more towards the corporate side. So, you know, whereas the agencies that responded, you know, are absolutely in that consumer space and they demonstrated that in the way that they responded. So I thought it was fun and, you know, worthy of engaging in. And I think it was probably a learning process for everyone who was either participating or observing. And, you know, interesting to see who they actually select at the end of the day.
Well, that's all we have time for today. A big thank you to Launch Group's Fleur Brown.
Thank you, Robin. It's been fun.
And podcast producer Alice Terlikovsky.
Thanks, Robin.
The Mumbrellacast was recorded at the studios of CBS Interactive. Ciao for now.